she was hopeful for hours that they would be pulled out alive by the paramedics from the rubble where her home once stood. And I think this photo is incredible, Amy, as well, because, you know, it's probably, again, when people have seen them, it's one which really stayed with them. It's graphic in a way, but it's not graphic in another. But the emotion that you have when you see this image again, you know, very strong, and it makes you understand again what we were talking about before. What does this war look like day in, day out for people and families and children in Gaza? You know, seeing a child's feet under the rubble, you know, again, makes you understand the war quite differently than just reading about it.
Charlotte Kanz, head of photography for OCHA, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. She coordinated the Gaza Collective Photo Essay Project. Charlotte said these are not just photojournalists. These are also civilians. They're witnesses and victims to the horrible conflict that we're seeing unfolding in front of our eyes. We particularly thank Charlotte for this interview. She was in Paris after the passing of her mother this week. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shurfado Kadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Aspi, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is a Legal ID. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and I am Dr. Demento, just barely legal.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? If so, The Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be Friday afternoons at 3. Dale Farr will give you a history lesson from the birth of rock and roll through the 50s and 60s, and Ray Bodwell will mine the 60s and 70s for the deep cuts, hidden gems, and variety that you won't hear on generic classic rock stations. So tune in to The Roots of Rock and Roll, Fridays at 3 p.m. on KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, traffic deaths in 2023 in Portland were the highest in 30 years.
A fire at Timberline Lodge closes hotel until Sunday at least.
And Portland joins a national carjacking task force.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 19th, 2024. I'm Zoe Carina.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland's 69 traffic deaths in 2023 were the highest in 30 years. That's according to Portland Bureau of Transportation's Deadly Traffic Crash Report. The findings are a grim reality check in a city committed to ending traffic deaths by 2025. Of the 69 people who died in 2023, 32 perished in motor vehicles, 11 on motorcycles, and 2 on bicycles. The remaining 24 were pedestrians, classified by PBOT as those walking, as well as using mobility devices, skateboards, or e-scooters. Portland adopted its Vision Zero plan in late 2016, with the goal to, quote, eliminate traffic deaths and serious injuries on Portland's streets, end quote. Now, The City Council is adopting its first update to the action plan since 2019. The latest Vision Zero update through 2025 acknowledges the report's findings that traffic deaths are on the rise. It also claims major safety gains made by PayBot since the plan's 2016 adoption. Speaking with City Council yesterday, PBOT Commissioner Mingus Mapps repeated his wishes for increased PBOT funding. Mapps said, quote, "Where we have invested, we have had success," end quote.
For transportation safety advocates, however, the report is a glaring example of how the Vision Zero plan has contributed little more than lip service to a local crisis. Local transportation safety activist Sarah Risser submitted a written comment to the April 17th City Council meeting. Risser wrote, quote, "I am under the very strong impression that Portland's Vision Zero program exists to signal a desire for zero road fatalities and, by doing so, allow leaders to evade the hard work that is needed to realize its goal," end quote. Critics like Risser also expressed disappointment that PBOT did not take more responsibility for its failures at combating persistent traffic violence trends. Roughly 75% of traffic deaths last year occurred in Portland's busiest streets, within the city's high crash network. The high crash network mostly encompasses wider, multi-lane streets. Although these only account for less than a tenth of Portland streets, they accounted for nearly three-quarters of traffic deaths last year. The high crash network is concentrated in East Portland. This is a contributing factor to the report's findings that traffic violence disproportionately impacts Portland's Black community. The report also found traffic violence disproportionately impacting Portland's homeless population, which speaks to, quote, "the extreme risks of persistent exposure to traffic," end quote. The local traffic safety advocacy nonprofit, the Street Trust, released its list of actionable steps the city could take to counteract these trends. It calls for limiting speeds to 20 miles per hour throughout the high crash network, investments in more automated traffic enforcement, and to support funding for safety projects on state-owned roads in next year's legislative session.
The Timberline Lodge is closed until at least Sunday, after a fire broke out in the attic of the historic building late last night. The ski area was also closed today. John Burton, the marketing director at Timberline, told KGW that he thinks embers from the main chimney caused the fire. Employees tried to put it out with extinguishers, but were unsuccessful. Then they went door to door evacuating guests. All guests were able to safely evacuate the lodge, and no injuries were reported. Reports of the fire first started coming in sometime around 9:30 p.m. Flames were seen shooting out from a corner of the building. Fire crews from Hoodland, Clackamas, Gresham, and Estacada Fire responded. Officials have not released details about the extent of damage to the building. Timberline management noted there was a lot of water inside the main lobby area, though there was no internal smoke or fire damage. Teams have been working to move artwork and furniture. Timberline said damage inside appears to be minimal. Burton said, quote, "This is a first one for us here at Timberline. I think we just need to look at this, as it could have been a lot worse. It was extremely windy, so it didn't help the cause, but I can't thank the first responders enough," end quote. Investigators with the U.S. Forest Service are working to determine the official cause of the fire. Timberline Lodge was built in 1937 and was declared a national landmark in 1977.
Oregon lawmakers passed a major housing package in this year's session, but say easing the state's housing crisis will take more work. Bills passed during the short legislative session will send a total of $376 million to address the state's housing shortage. That includes Senate Bill 1530 and Senate Bill 1537, priorities for Governor Tina Kotek. Head of Habitat for Humanity of Oregon, Shannon Vilhar, says the governor's housing package is groundbreaking.
We also see important investments in emergency housing assistance, addiction recovery support, and renters protection. So those are all investments that are going to help stabilize Oregonians in need of housing assistance and benefit the communities we all share.
The housing package includes funds for housing and homelessness projects and to support counties buying land and developing properties. However, Vilhar says there's still more to do to address the crisis. During the next legislative session, she hopes the state will help first-time homebuyers as well as make other investments.
preserving affordable rental homes that exist now but are at risk of terming out of their affordability and going market rate. We'd love to see that affordable housing preservation investment move forward in a strong way.
Vilhauer says the housing issue in Oregon can't be solved immediately. It's a problem that's been decades in the making.
It will take a concerted effort over time to continue to make headway, which we're starting to get there, but we need to keep going with a sustained effort.
That was Shannon Vilhauer, the executive director of Habitat for Humanity, Oregon.
Two competing camping bans will be subject to a hearing before City Council next week. The original proposal was put forward by Mayor Ted Wheeler's office for a hearing this past Thursday, but it was rescheduled for this coming Wednesday after Commissioner Renee Gonzalez put forward an amendment. Gonzalez proposed increasing Wheeler's penalties from $100 or a week in jail to $100 or up to 30 days in jail. Gonzalez, who is running for mayor, also proposes moving the future rulemaking authority around camping bans to the office of the mayor, not the city council. He also included language that would automatically make the rule stricter if the Supreme Court strikes down restrictions on local camping bans when it rules on the case Grants Pass versus Johnson. That would include fines up to $500, up to 6 months in jail, and a blanket ban on all camping on public land. Currently, a Ninth Circuit Court decision limits the city's ability to ban all camping, and next week's ordinance focuses on types of camping and camping-related activities. Gonzalez's amendments faced stern opposition from Wheeler and Commissioner Carmen Rubio, who is also running for mayor, and Gonzalez has watered it down since then. The amendments now align with Wheeler's original penalties of $100 or 7 days in jail, but still include the authority being vested in the mayor and the automatic ban on all camping, pending the Supreme Court decision. The hearing on the original proposal and the Gonzalez amendments will be Wednesday the 24th at 2 p.m. As of today, there are 33 written comment submissions, roughly five times as many opposing the ban as there are endorsing it.
Civil rights activists say a court ruling could end the right to protest in three southern states. A federal judge lets January 6 lawsuits proceed against former President Trump, and police arrest dozens at a Columbia University Gaza protest. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Does this now mean that the organizers of January 6th should also risk financial ruin? I mean, you had police officers hurt there. People were killed.
Civil rights attorney Ben Crump questions if a court ruling against Black Lives Matter organizers should also apply to the Capitol insurrection. The Fifth Circuit says activists who staged a BLM event can be held liable by a police officer injured by protesters. Civil rights advocates say that could effectively end the right to protest for states in the district, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. 12 jurors have been selected in former President Donald Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan. Opening statements could begin Monday. Meanwhile, a federal judge says lawsuits filed by police and members of Congress against Trump for January 6th can proceed. California Congresswoman Barbara Lee is the lead plaintiff in an NAACP lawsuit.
Our democracy was at risk. It was an assault on our democracy, and in our lawsuit, we are saying that we must hold him accountable.
The Supreme Court is set to hear arguments next week on Trump's claim he has unlimited lifetime immunity from prosecution for presidential actions, including on January 6th. More than 100 Columbia University students were arrested Thursday after refusing to take down what they call a Gaza solidarity encampment on campus. Jewish graduate student Kim Silverman tells CBS she no longer feels safe there.
To hear them cheering intifada right now, when that instilled so much fear in so many Jews all around the world, is just really disturbing.
Wednesday, Columbia's president told a congressional committee it's challenging to both protect Jewish students from harassment and ensure free speech. Anti-vaccine activist and minor party presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has qualified for the ballot in Michigan, where the last two elections were decided by less than 1% of the vote. For the second time in 2 weeks, Arizona Republicans have blocked repeal of the state's near-total abortion ban. State Representative Oscar De Los Santos says voters want it repealed.
It is time for Republicans to listen to the vast majority of Arizonans and to stop silencing us.
Blue state legislatures are seeing dozens of bills this year to stop book bans and protect librarians, but those are being outpaced by legislation going the other direction. West Virginia lawmakers passed a bill to make librarians criminally liable for running what State Delegate Brandon Steele describes as sanctuaries of pedophilia.
I'm here to protect children. I'm here to protect our young people and make sure that they are not put in a vulnerable position where they are presented with pure pornography.
Opponents say these laws whip up a frenzy of censorship and target books by and for minorities. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear, with an overnight low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow, warm temperatures continue, with a 30% chance of rain. The high will be 68. Today in history, in 1943, Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann becomes the first person to deliberately dose himself with LSD, 3 days after having synthesized the compound. This event is, strangely enough, celebrated as Bicycle Day. The quote of the day is from Hofmann, who said, "I know LSD. I don't need to take it anymore. Maybe when I die, like Aldous Huxley."
The Oregon U.S. Attorney's Office announced the launch of a new task force focused on carjacking in the state yesterday. In a press release, Natalie Witt, U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, says, quote, "We are pleased to join our Justice Department colleagues from across the country in taking this important, targeted step to address carjacking, a dangerous, violent crime," end quote. There are other agencies involved in the initiative, too, like the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and, quote, local law enforcement partners, end quote. KBOO reached out to the Portland Police Bureau to find out whether PPB members would be among the contributors to this project and who might lead the program from the Bureau's side. Sergeant Kevin Allen, the Bureau's public information officer, responded in an email saying, quote, "While we are still in the early stages of discussing our role in the task force, we welcome the additional resources and expertise of our federal law enforcement partners in addressing this problem and are looking forward to the collaboration," end quote. The National Incident-Based Reporting System is a database of crime stats submitted by law enforcement agencies around the country. It doesn't have a special classification for carjacking, so it can be difficult to track down statistics. Sergeant Allen estimated the number of potential carjackings have slowly but steadily declined over the last 3 years. Incident reports with robbery carjack offense codes are down from 153 incidents in 2021 to 125 last year.
Basic Rights Oregon, the state's leading LGBTQ+ advocacy group, is affirming that all youth, including transgender youth, have the right to play sports with their peers in Oregon. The group says, quote, "We reject the attempts to manufacture hateful hysteria by some in power in our state government," end quote. A 2022 study by the National Library of Medicine shows that suicidal thoughts and actions are directly caused by preventable risk factors. These risk factors include an overall lack of support from friends, family, and others, microaggressions, and adverse childhood experiences. Now, transgender youth are seeing a change in behavior from federal government officials. Today, the Department of Education announced new rules updating Title IX of the Education's Amendments Act of 1972. During former President Trump's time in office, he decreased the previous number of protections for victims of sexual assault and harassment. The new rules specify protections for LGBTQ+ students and aim to ensure that no one experiences gender discrimination in federally funded schools. The rule change related to sports is still ongoing, but advocacy groups urge the government to allow all students to have the same educational experience free of discrimination. Casey Pick, director of law and policy at the Trevor Project, the nation's largest suicide prevention and crisis intervention organization for LGBTQ+ youth, said the new rules are an important step in the protection of LGBTQ students who face discrimination simply for being themselves.
The Oregon Department of Human Services may be helping local nursing homes hide serious problems. That's according to a report from the state's long-term care ombudsman, Fred Steele. The DHS website lists long-term care facilities in Oregon. This list crucially includes a red box to show whether the facility is facing formal regulatory sanctions from the agency. Steele's report, however, highlights an agency policy that allows these facilities to address sanctions privately. Facilities who sign a letter of agreement with the DHS acknowledge violations and the demands made by the agency. In exchange, they avoid a condition on their license, which triggers the red box. For Steele's office, the letters are fundamentally the same as the conditions, only they let facilities avoid public scrutiny. They see the letters as a contributing factor in an ongoing preventable death case at a Sandy Memory Care facility. In a statement to Willamette Week, DHS spokeswoman Elisa Williams defended the letters of agreement. Williams said, quote, "Letters of agreement are a tool in incentivizing licensed facilities to address problems proactively," end quote. Willamette Week's review of inspection reports found letters addressing serious infractions. They also found some agreements have remained in effect 4 years. Steele said, quote, "The use of these letters is a representation of a regulatory system intended to be consumer protection oriented that tends to be supportive of private business first," end quote.
Graduation season is approaching, but some Native students are preparing to face resistance for wanting to wear tribal regalia with their graduation garb. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As high school and college students plan for their graduations, some Native students could face resistance for wanting to wear tribal regalia with their caps and gowns. Each graduation season, attorneys say they hear from Native students who are denied being able to wear cultural items, as the Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports.
For Native communities, an eagle feather is a symbol of wisdom and strength, and given in times of great honor, like a graduation. But every spring, the Native American Rights Fund hears from students who were not allowed to wear an eagle feather or other tribal regalia. Morgan Saunders is an attorney with the Colorado-based law group. She says parents often break down in tears when they discuss their child being denied their tribal identity.
For many families, the wearing of the eagle feather is more important than the diploma because it's something that's given at this important time in their child's life. They're transitioning, you know, often into adulthood.
More than a dozen states have laws to protect a Native student's right to wear tribal regalia, including Nevada, Colorado, and Utah. Saunders says families in states without those protections should review their school district's policies and request dress code accommodations as early as possible. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Nunam Ikwa in the Yupik language means land's end, a place on the Bering Sea coast of Alaska that is so flat, it's hard to tell where the land meets the sea. But when it comes to spelling, this community stands tall. The championship for this year's statewide Yupik Spelling Bee went to Nunam Ikwa. The tournament was held at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. KMBA's Rhonda McBride was there.
Please keep to yourselves and be quiet.
Spelling bees aren't the best of spectator sports, but families and coaches filled about 50 seats in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Acceleration Building with lots of cell phone cameras ready to roll.
I'm happy for the students, nervous at the same time, and I have butterflies in my stomach.
Although Marina Barner can't cheer out loud, she's here to support a student from Bethel. And like everyone else in this room, she has to keep quiet to help the students concentrate. But that sense of pride they feel speaks volumes.
To be here and watching my daughter, I cannot express how it makes me feel. I'm proud of her.
Thomas Carl's daughter Megan is only a fifth grader, but like the rest of the kids here, she is a shining star of hope in her community to keep the Yupik language, or Yuktun, alive.
Angyongtuk, Angyongtuk, Angyongtuk.
They're awesome. The way their brains can
connected.
Samantha Afghan coached this year's champion from Newnham Iqua, Kirsten Manumic, a seventh grader, as well as Jalen Strongheart, a fifth grader who finished third. They spent hours and hours every week to prepare for the competition, and one of the carrots, a trip to Anchorage. Afghan says she loved to hear them driving around town.
Oh, look at that car. Oh, look at that truck. Look at that tree.
Excitement for kids who live in a place where there's not so much as a hill. This year's competition also included an Inupiaq spelling bee with two students and a dance group that performed a song called The Polar Bear Shake to celebrate. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The effects of the 2020 redistricting cycle, where state and local governments updated political boundaries based on the latest U.S. Census, are still being felt today. Tribal governments and legal assistance groups are maintaining their push to keep in place the legal wins they've secured for fair maps. Mike Moen reports from North Dakota.
Across the U.S., most political boundaries tied to the 2020 census have been in place for a while. But a national project on map fairness for indigenous populations continues to fight for changes, with North Dakota at the center of the movement. When states did their redistricting a few years ago, the Native American Rights Fund launched its Fair Districting in Indian County effort. It provides resources and legal representation to tribal communities worried about newly drawn districts that could suppress their voting power. NARF staff attorney Michael Carter says there's been a lot of activity.
Just from this redistricting cycle alone, tribes have stepped up and decided that what the state and county governments are doing is not right.
He points to several cases with various levels of success, including two high-profile ones from North Dakota. One resulted in a new legislative map for the 2024 election. The state is appealing that decision, arguing the plaintiffs lack the authority to submit a challenge. The Native American Rights Fund expects oral arguments within the next few months. Carter says a section of the Voting Rights Act is often at the center of these cases, with tribal advocates arguing some state and local governments aren't honoring language that prohibits voter discrimination. He says there's a separate movement out there trying to reverse the progress.
The national implications are there just from the attention it's getting from all the other states that are filing these briefs in the appeals courts seeking to undo the wins that Native voters got in the lower courts.
A group of Republican attorneys general contends that private groups and individuals don't have the right to file lawsuits under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. But Carter says there's a separate provision used in the North Dakota case that does provide that opportunity. NARF and its partner organization notes their movement has ushered in a new generation of Native American lawyers to fight for civil rights in the years to come. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
An annual March for Farm Workers' Rights is being held on Sunday in Northwest Washington. This year, marchers are focusing on the conditions for local tulip and daffodil workers. Alfredo Juarez with the Farm Workers' Rights Organization Community to Community Development says tulip and daffodil harvesters are raising concerns about pay, pesticide use near where they're working, and the need for clean restrooms. He says the march coincides with the Skagit Valley Tulip Festival.
During the tourist season, when you show up here, you see all the beautiful flowers with different colors, design, but the work that goes into making all that happen is done by the workers and the people that you don't really see. You just see the flowers.
The Farm Workers March, known as La Marcha Campesina, starts at 10 a.m. in Mount Vernon. The Skagit Valley Tulip Festival is the largest tulip festival in the country and draws 1 million visitors annually. Juarez says the workers want to see better conditions in the fields.
We really like doing the job. It just gets very tough and it's hard for us sometimes when we do so much so everybody else enjoys it. But for us, when we're doing the work, it's tough.
The march will follow a 7.5-mile loop. Juarez notes the march typically takes place in May, but the date was changed this year to coincide with the Tulip Festival.
A third of U.S. adults are interested in cutting back on meat, a new report finds. Health and cost are the driving motivations, but plant-rich meals can also help the climate. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
About a third of U.S. adults say they're interested in reducing the amount of meat they eat, even if they're not planning to become vegetarian or vegan.
Which is a really exciting finding because it's showing that food culture is beginning to bend in a more sustainable direction.
Eve Turrell-Paul is founder and executive director of the Food for Climate League. The nonprofit partnered on a recent report about people's eating habits and attitudes about plant-forward diets.
Plants really are at the forefront of the meal, and meat or other animal products such as dairy, butter, are going to be playing a supporting role to the plants. And by plants, we're not just talking about leafy greens. We're talking about whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes. It runs the whole gamut.
According to the report, most people considering a more plant-forward diet are motivated by health or cost. But eating less meat also helps the climate. It reduces the deforestation caused by animal agriculture, and it helps limit climate warming methane emissions from cows.
We don't need the whole world to be vegan and vegetarian. We do need everyone to be reducing the amount of animal protein that they are consuming.
So she's excited that more people are getting hungry for plant-forward meals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 19th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Jasmine Moss, Reed Johnson, Birdie, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm.